Hello, what have we here?
Hey everyone, welcome back to Resistance Radio. It's episode 61. Hope you all enjoyed last week's show, because this week it's all about Kanan Jarrus. As always, I'm Mikey B, joined by my co-host, Danya.
Hey everyone.
And we also have Evan joining us today. Hey Evan.
Hey there, how y'all doing?
If you want to get involved in the conversation, you can get a hold of us on Twitter at our radio podcast. Leave a comment on our Facebook. Send us an email through our website, resistanceradio.net, or leave a comment on this post when it goes up on hypeable.com. Also, today's podcast is brought to you by audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/resistanceradio. With over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, get the latest Star Wars audiobook for free. We've also launched our Patreon. Check it out at patreon.com/resistanceradiopodcast. We have some amazing perks, including joining us in our Discord chat, where you can join us in our recording studio, join us for movie nights, download that movie audio so you'll have your own riff track slash audio commentary of the movie. After Dark episodes, which will focus around the extended universe or Legends. What else do we have there, Donnie? I'm trying to think of all the stuff off the top of my head.
I think you pretty much hit everything.
T-shirts? We got t-shirts, too. You can get t-shirts for it.
Yeah.
And exclusive posts. Funny stuff, yeah. True. So check us out on Patreon. Yeah, it's good. We also have t-shirts and buttons available on our website if you want to rock those. I actually had a story that I actually got stopped wearing my Resistance Radio t-shirt yesterday, and someone's like, hey, how can I join the Resistance? Because that's what the t-shirt says. It was pretty cool to just randomly get stopped by a Star Wars fan and start talking about the podcast. But I think it's time for the news. So there's two things. Well, I guess maybe two things we really want to talk about this week. One, Star Wars turns 40. For us, it's going to be tomorrow, or for you who are listening to this on Sunday, was on Thursday, the 25th. So I asked earlier, and I'm going to put these guys on the spot. Are you guys doing any plans for official, real Star Wars Day, the 40th anniversary? Danya?
No. I mean, by virtue of the fact that, one, it's a weekday and I have a job, and and two, just I don't live anywhere near anything where there would be events or anything happening, so other than maybe at some point watching A New Hope, maybe when I get home at some point in the evening, no.
Yeah. Evan, you doing anything special?
Nothing super special. I always like have these grand plans of like, ooh, what are we going to do this year? And nothing ever happens. But we may try to do some Xbox streaming on Twitch.
Oh,
either
nice.
Of Force Unleashed. We started that again. Or maybe Battlefront, but we do that quite a bit. Actually, we might do Lego Star Wars complete, because that's on Games with Gold right now.
Oh, nice. Very nice. Yeah, I'm going to watch A New Hope. My mom actually texted me this week. She's like, hey, are you going to watch Star Wars on Thursday? Because she actually was one of the lucky few. I guess not lucky few, but she actually saw it on the 25th in 1977 at the Grauman's Chinese. And there's pictures of her at that premiering shows. And I got to see it when the special edition came out at the Grauman's in Hollywood. So it's one of those things, my mom and I, we've always bonded over Star Wars. So I'm going to get to watch it, A New Hope, and convince my wife to go into a Disney store, because I want to see the BB-8 action figures that they have and all the games they have with the droids happening tomorrow for, you know, the anniversary of it. So I'm excited for 40th anniversary. But the big news this week, Danya, I know you wrote a bunch of this and we're going to talk about it, is this Vanity Fair article, or Vanity Fair, you know, covers. The Star Wars had, what, 4 exclusive covers featuring The Last Jedi, and the cover story was just absolutely incredible. It's a very long cover story. I think it took me 20-25 minutes to get through the whole thing, and I had to reread it a couple times to really just soak in all the information and bits of news and everything. So if you're a fan of avoiding all spoilers, you might want to skip to the spotlight topic and not listen to the news. So let's just kind of go through this Vanity Fair news, guys. Does that work for you?
Sure. I mean,
absolutely.
We don't want to talk about the covers at all, or...
Well, that's what we're going to start with. This is all the Vanity Fair stuff, the news. So we're going to start with the covers. The first cover, you know, what you guys think about the Ray and Luke one?
The thing that interested me the most about this one specifically is that, obviously up until now, like even in the trailer and at the end of Force Awakens, we had like a brief look at him, but we didn't really get a lot of detail on like his costume. Whereas this, you like really see a lot of detail, specifically the glove that he's wearing. Now, in the trailer, there was someone tucking the old Jedi symbol that had like a brown leather glove, and it's been subject to a lot of debate over like who was touching it, whose glove that was. And now we can say with certainty that it's Luke, because it's the same glove that he's wearing in this cover.
Yeah. I do find it interesting that he shows the right gloved hand is what's on the cover with him. Now, it's not like he's like, the hand is on the cover, but, you know, he's standing there next to Daisy, and, you know, he's got his Jedi robe and cloak on, and the only, you know, his other hand is, you know, folded underneath the cloak, but it's the right hand, you know, the robotic hand, and the glove that we see inside the trailer that is the one that's showing.
I mean, it's cold. So you would assume that,
but
like,
Daisy doesn't have gloves on, and she's wearing short sleeves.
Yeah, but just saying, Luke is an old man now, and he gets cold very, very easily, and he can't get sick, because you know what happens when you're older and you get sick.
He's yelling at Daisy, "Get off my rock, you whippersnapper!" You know, I don't know. I personally love this one just because, like, he definitely gives me a very Obi-Wan Kenobi kind of hermit. On Tatooine type vibe with the cloak, the beard. Like, it's good to see Luke featured in something. Because, you know, obviously, you know, Force Awakens was like, oh, we're going to get the original trio back. And then all of a sudden it's like, it's the hunt for Luke Skywalker. And he's not in it at all, except the very end. Which is, it was good, but it didn't have Luke Skywalker. Mm. But I get it. You know, it would be all about Luke. Evan, what do you think of this first cover here?
I mean, it's great. It's fantastic to see more Luke, like you just said, and more Rey. I mean, we need more Rey in our lives.
True.
But of all the covers, it's probably the one that did the least for me.
Yeah.
I guess just because it's, you know, we could have easily have seen that shot at the end of the last movie. Whereas some
That's
of the
true.
Other covers are like, here's some new stuff, here's different looks to the people, let's get pumped up about new characters in this movie, or let's rip your heart out and make you cry while you're driving to work.
Oh, we know what cover that is. We'll talk about that in a second. Well, let's move on to the next cover. So the next cover is the villains cover, if you will. It's got Kylo Ren, General Hux, and Phasma on it. And we've heard that Kylo Ren doesn't wear the mask as much in this new film. So we see Adam Driver's face, but we also see Phasma's face. You know, she, you know, Gwendolyn Christie's not wearing her helmet, and it's not like she's holding it or anything. What do you guys just think of this cover? Like, in general, one, I think it's awesome. Like, Phasma's holding some type of pike. I was asking, is it a force pike? Hux is looking snarky like his self. And obviously Driver's got that wonderful scar on his face that Rey and Finn kind of fought with him gave. What do you guys think?
I liked it. The interesting part, other than like Kylo Ren not wearing his helmet, is the fact that his outfit is different as well. It's less jagged and less like ripped and torn and frayed edges. It's a lot sleeker, a lot cleaner than his outfit from Force Awakens. So there's that as well. So I don't know if that's like an outward sort of manifestation of his current mental state versus, obviously, he's very conflicted throughout Force Awakens, so I don't know if that's solidifying his position a little more in The Last Jedi or not, and that's a signifier for it, but I thought it was a very interesting choice to not have that carry on to this film. But also, I'm really into Phasma's whole look. Like, I think she looks so cool. Like, so cool. I love everything about the styling on her. It would be very, very difficult to believe that they will have a lot of Phasma in the Last Jedi with her not wearing her helmet. Only because at the beginning of The Force Awakens, she had that moment with Finn where she was basically like, who told you you could remove, or who gave you permission to remove your helmet? Which means that it's probably not very likely that she will remove it.
And well, we also see her with it in the trailer. Like, she's wearing the helmet after, you know, you see Luke walk up with the, you know, burning, and then her and the stormtroopers walk in, she's got her helmet on, so.
Yeah, well, I guess you would if you're going back, right?
That would make sense.
You know, Kylo Ren.
Yeah, but Kylo Ren is unstable and also kind of idiot. So.
I will say, out of all the three on this cover, Hux is probably the most, I don't want to say let me down, but it's one that I'm just like, oh, it's cool. Hux is on there too. Whereas Phasma makes me like, oh man, it looks amazing. Can't wait to see how Phasma's character evolves. Same thing with Adam Driver looking super moody, you know, coming off of having killed his dad, you know, and then there's Hux. His station destroyed.
It almost looks like Kylo is like subtly trying to like push him out of the picture.
Does.
It's like, yeah. No, this is all about me.
Yeah, it does feel that way. Like, it's kind of like, you know, obviously, you know, Hux is going to be important to the First Order, and we see this in the novels and everything, but for him on this cover, it was just kind of like meh to me. Where, like I said, you know, Kylo Ren and Captain Phasma on here just like totally steal it. But let's move on to the next one. Let's look at our heroes here. And I'm super excited for this one. We have, you know, we have Poe and Finn, and then we got Rose just hanging out there too, and then BB-8 in the bottom. So you have like four amazing things on here. Like, I absolutely love this one.
This one's
and
my
I love
favorite.
That Finn is standing up and not in the back to tank, you know. Go, Danya. You can just gush over it.
This is my favorite. Not least because, holy crap, did we ever think that we would get to a point where we would have three heroes from the Star Wars universe who are people of color on the cover of Vanity Fair magazine together as a group. Like,
and be able to be their own cover. Like, just be that awesome.
Yes. I mean, the huge thing here is that Kelly Marie Tran, who is playing Rose, is the first Asian female to ever be on the cover of Vanity Fair magazine.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah.
Yep.
That is awesome.
Yeah, so but this...
And does that mean BB-8's like the first droid ever to be on the cover of Vanity Fair?
I don't actually know.
I'm sure R2 has been on.
Probably. So, wow.
At some point.
But yeah, this one is making history in terms of Vanity Fair magazine. I mean, It's ridiculous that it's taken until 2017 for that to be the case, but just the fact that it's Star Wars making history again, like, that's incredible.
Breaking boundaries, like one of our patrons mentioned, it's a bit of an embarrassing stat for Vanity Fair.
Oh yeah,
but it's even worse if I just made this joke about, is it the first time a droid's on the cover? And it's not the first time a droid's on the cover, but it's the first time that an Asian female has. Like, that is really, really an embarrassing stat for Vanity Fair.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. You know. I mean, it shouldn't have taken this long for it to happen, but I'm glad that it has finally happened. The other thing that is incredible about it, which we'll get to later, is that there was another little piece of news that was revealed in the cover story for this, which is really exciting, and we'll get to that soon.
Between Poe and somebody else. Let's move on.
Yes.
So, anything else about this cover? Like, yes. You guys want to say anything else about the cover?
Yes.
Like, please, keep going.
Okay,
keep
okay, going. Okay. One, Finn has basically woken up late and just thrown on all of Poe's clothes. Can we just say that? Because he is wearing Poe's entire outfit from
there's so many jokes there.
I know.
Alright, but come on, like, what's he gonna put on his stormtrooper outfit? He left that on Jakku. He's got nothing.
I mean, clearly whatever he was wearing before has been left somewhere else as well, and he's just borrowed whatever Poe had lying around. And Poe's decided, I'll just wear something else, it's fine.
From Han Solo's closet.
Yeah, exactly. So Poe is wearing Han's old outfit, like, literally down to the jacket, like, in the belt. Like, it's exactly what Han was wearing. And Finn is now wearing what Poe was wearing.
The jacket, the shirt, the pants, even the pants. Like, is that the same blaster? No, it's not the same blaster. No.
Do you know what I'm wondering? Will Rose at some point during the film wear the jacket? Because it's gone from Poe to Finn, then Finn to Rey wore it for a little bit, then back to Finn. Now that Rose has kind of come in as, like, we've now got this... Now we've got the four of them. We've got, what, Poe, Finn, Rose, and Rey. Now she clearly has to wear that to become part of this group.
I see her wearing that jacket is if her and Finn trade jackets for some reason. Because Finn needs to wear a jacket. Or if
at some point Rose gets cold like Rey did.
Aww. I wonder if there's like a weird, like, awkward moment where when Finn's working with Rose, if he asks if she has a boyfriend, pretty boyfriend also. But, you know.
the only thing about this picture that would have made it better, and this is a total, like, photography nerd framing thing for me, Kelly Marie Tran should have been in the middle, flanked by the bros.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. She should have been in the middle of that sandwich. Like,
except then the anniversary edition banner on Vanity Fair would have been over Finn's face. I'm sorry. Like, there is a very obvious reason why she wasn't. If you look at that banner, it literally, like, wraps around Kelly Marie Tran, Rose's head, Kelly Marie Tran's
head.
Hold on.
Why is that the case when Hux is significantly taller than Kelly Marie Tran and is by the anniversary banner on the previous cover? So I'm sorry, fly.
We already talked about that Hux was trying to be pushed out of the photo, so... You know,
yeah, whatever. But, like, it's not that the banner would be in front of Finn's face. Finn would be in front of the banner.
You'd like to think that, but no.
All right.
I was trying to give them a way.
An out.
An out here, okay?
Yeah, but I she should be in the middle.
Fine, let's just move on to the next one so we can all just cry for a little bit. Yep. All right, so before we talk about this one, can I just say, as soon as I saw him, like, I want that cloak. Like, how amazing is that? Like, you guys know I love Lando, and, like, I want a cape, but honestly, like, if I had this cloak, I would just be like, hello. Like, nonstop, like, just be, like, super, like, I know I'm not suave, but I feel like I'd be, like, amazing with this cloak. Like, look at how big that collar is.
She looks incredible. Like,
she looks incredible. It's amazing.
This entire look. It is so damn cool. I love it. I love everything about this. And I will admit that I got really misty-eyed. Like, look at this cover. There is a tweet going around, which is both hilarious, but also, like, yes, I agree, is basically someone being like, hang this in the Louvre. In France.
It could.
It's kind of amazing. But yeah, so this cover, I think I said, like I said, I personally feel like the Rey Luke one is probably my favorite, just because I'm like a Jedi one, but this one right here had a special place. Like, if I had to have one, like, printed out and framed, I'd probably want that one. Just because it is so, it's everything that you think of when you think of Princess Leia meets General Leia. So we saw General Leia in more, I guess, military style gear in The Force Awakens. Here, she is the senator, the former princess of Alderaan. Like, this is very regal of Carrie Fisher and of, you know, Leia as a character. And this is everything I wanted out of that character. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say so. And I just now managed to make myself even sadder because, you know, obviously we've lost Carrie Fisher and it's a very powerful picture. But thinking about the character of Leia, she's supposed to have Han with her. And,
I know.
And he's not there. And you can almost see, like, he should be there and he's not.
Now I'm getting all teary-eyed. Thanks, Evan. Like, yeah, you can see how, like, he should have his arm draped around her. Like, yeah.
By the way, I looked it up, and BB-8 has been on the cover of Vanity Fair 4 in June 2015, but not only that, on a couple of, like, fold-out covers, where, like, you have the cover and then you fold them out so it becomes, like, a super long extended cover. C-3PO and R2 have been on one of those, and then R2 has been on another one. And, hilariously, Jar Jar has been on a cover as well.
Oh, good gosh.
Wow. That is a really bad stat for Vanity Fair. Oh, well. But anything else about the Leia cover, guys, before we move on to this amazing cover story?
I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, we can't talk about it too much or we'll all end up crying.
We'll cry. We're gonna cry.
Yeah.
All right, so this cover story we got, I thought it was really well crafted and it was a great story. It covered a lot of different things, and I don't want to cover everything, but we have quite a few things I want to make sure just we talk about, because a lot of it is semi-spoilerish with some new stuff. But it's an interesting take on how it started off. It kind of goes in different, like, chapters, if you will, sections. Interviews with the actual actors to talking about their characters and just different things that happen. We start off, you know, I guess we can start off with the way you put your notes here, Donya. But we start off with Finn, and he begins the new movie in a Bacta suit. We kind of saw this in the trailer. And he kind of progresses from that. What do you guys think that, you know, when you talk to John Boyega about him starting off in this Bacta suit, I love how everyone's a little coy about, like, what's gonna happen, even though this is like a tell-all article about the definitive preview of The Last Jedi.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense considering we're picking up immediately where The Force Awakens ended. I guess a lot of us assumed that there would be some kind of, like, repercussions from his injuries. Like, he wasn't going to bounce back immediately. There was going to be some longer form of recovery. So him beginning the new movie in a Bacta suit makes a lot of sense. And I'm glad that they've sort of confirmed that as well. I guess for me, the longer term sort of thing is, like, will there be long-term effects of his injuries, depending on how quickly he needs to recover. We know that he's going to be going on missions at some point during The Last Jedi, which we'll get to a little bit later. But if that is the case, does he end treatment before he's supposed to? Does he go back to the field and fight the resistance before he's ready and fully, like, back to 100% physically? Like, if he's in the Bacta suit, like, how long is he in it for?
Yeah. My other question is he fully with the resistance now? Like, has he made that decision? Or is he with the resistance purely because he's being healed by them? You know, remember, he really not wanted to do anything. He was tired of fighting the First Order. The only reason he joined back was to help find Rey. And even then, like, he had that wonderful line of, you know, he really didn't know what he was going to do. And Han's like, we have people counting on us. It's like, we'll use the Force. You know, that's not how the Force works. Like, he really wasn't doing it. He was doing it for very selfish reasons. And don't get me wrong. Like, I love Finn and John Boyega. But I'm almost wondering, you know, what are we going to see? Like, is he just, like, full on, like, hey, I'm joining the Resistance. I'm now a special, Like, is he like Luke Skywalker in Empire Strikes Back, where he's Commander Skywalker, he's now Commander Finn?
I mean, I would probably say that his journey is more akin to Han Solo's, in that Han did a lot of stuff initially that was very selfish and very specific gain. You know, he was after credits in order to pay off Jabba. Like, he did it for very specific, very selfish reasons. But he did end up fighting with the Rebel Alliance. He ended up staying for other reasons. I feel like we're probably going to get a similar struggle in Finn, wherein a lot of the time what he is doing may, to some extent, have had selfish origins, but in the long term, he will do what is right. And the interesting thing will be seeing that struggle. Because, like I said, in this story, we know that he does go on a mission for the Resistance with another character. So it's very obvious that at some point he will decide to stay and go on that mission, but it's finding out what that turning point is. Why does he decide to stay? Does someone convince him? Has he changed it when he wakes up again? Has he become more galvanized in the idea of, like, fighting alongside the Resistance to free them from the First Order? Or is he just at the point where he's like, I'll do this one last thing for you, and then I'm running away? So there's a lot that you can explore with him, but I feel like he'll go on a very similar journey to Han. But unlike Han, I feel like, how to put this without seeming like I hate Han Solo. Don't. Han never got past his selfishness. You see it a little bit throughout, and I'm not saying inherently that that is a bad thing, just that he's still very much is the same Han Solo when we meet him in Force Awakens as he ever was. And yeah, like I said, I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but I feel like Finn has a different personality type. So that kind of inherent selfishness, or I guess it's not self, it's like self-interest. Like doing things to, I guess, further yourself and make yourself the most comfortable, and not doing things predominantly for other people. Like, it's a very, very tight-knit sort of small circle of people. I feel like Finn, when faced with the right kind of motivation, will do things for the greater good, because he's seen what the First Order is capable of. He just needs the nudge in the right direction. Because you see, first of all, how quickly, like, he almost imprints on Poe, then on Rey, and how close they get, and so quickly as well. I feel like that's very much inherent in his personality, that once he's surrounded by these people, it's gonna be that moment of clarity and kind of, oh, I care. He's been through conditioning for God knows how many years that has almost, like, taking or tried to condition him to not care, but the one thing that we know about Finn is that he does. So I feel like it'll be a struggle, at least in the initial part of the film, but we've already got precedent for the direction in which Finn is probably going to go.
Yeah, I was going to say, if there's one thing that we saw in Force Awakens, and you did kind of already touch on this, is that nudge that you were talking about is the friendships that he's formed. Because even though not having read Before the Awakening, I know that he didn't really have friends. Obviously, he didn't have a family, much less friends that form those familial bonds with him. Like you said, he's already done immediately with Poe and with Rey. And, you know, I think we'll probably see that again with Rose. And that's going to be what keeps him going. Even if he's not a believer in the cause, he's going to fight for his friends.
Yeah.
And I think that's a cause in itself, is you know, that loyalty. If he couldn't have the loyalty to the First Order, he can at least have it to these people who have befriended him. So, yeah, we'll see where Finn goes in the story. But I do like that we got a little intro there. Moving on just a little bit, we have Luke. A great interview with Mark Hamill, also talking about hummus and carrot sticks, by the way, also, if you read the whole thing. But Luke is living in this Jedi village, if you will, on Octu, with a race of caretaker creatures, which they won't tell us what they are or what they're called, but all they can say is that they're not Ewoks, which I'm okay if they're not Ewoks, but I kind of hope that the people living with them are an alien species. I don't want them to be like just hermits or monks or something like that. Like, I would love if they're like Keelix or something like that, something that we've seen in the extended universe and stuff like that. Because I will say, I think I mentioned it, like the little huts look like the Keelix villages in Star Wars: The Old Republic and what we've seen in like some of the novels and stuff like that. But what do you guys think about these indigenous race of caretaker creatures?
Well, I mean, that specifically would suggest that they're not human. So calling them an indigenous race would suggest that they're some kind of alien species specific to this planet. So I would say that it's very likely that we are going to be introduced to a new species or new race of aliens again in the Star Wars universe, which is great. I love that idea. Also, I guess the joke now that we we've been making, and also based on the Wikipedia, is we can no longer say inhabited by birds and at least one Luke Skywalker. So that's a shame, knowing that, you know, there's more than just Luke and birds on this one.
So at least he wasn't alone. You know, he didn't talk to just himself and the birds.
True.
You know, he talked to somebody, maybe.
Very,
you know,
true.
We'll see what happens there.
Yeah, I mean, and it also makes sense that it's not walks as well, because you would, like, it doesn't, that doesn't make
trees.
Sense. Yeah, I was going to say, it just doesn't make sense that they would be there unless Luke took some with him.
Well, you know, maybe Wicket wanted to come along. Yeah, well, think about it. We had what do you call it? Was it not Sympathy Ewoks, but
yes, I know exactly
what you're talking about.
Like Therapy Ewok.
Therapy. You had Therapy Ewoks.
Oh my gosh.
The Ewoks were willing to leave Endor to become Therapy Ewoks for PTS syndrome rebel fighters after Return of the Jedi. We saw this in, what was it, one of the books.
Life Debt. I just re-listened to that episode of yours where you talked all about the Therapy Ewok.
There's nothing wrong with Therapy Ewoks. Like,
I'm going to throat punch Chuck Wendig.
that's probably one of my favorite things that's come out. That's canon. I love it. But yeah, so, you know, Luke, we get to see a little bit about Luke on here. Now, I do want to talk about some of the photos as we kind of walk through this, because if we're talking about Luke Skywalker, there is a picture, a fuller photo of the cover that starts off the cover, story of Luke and Rey. So it's the same photo, but then you see a little bit of the building background. And if you go a little further down, talking about Luke and Rey, you see this amazing photo of Daisy, I guess with her vest taken off. So it's just the shirt and, you know, the rest of her outfit, doing lightsaber training. And I will say, obviously, seeing Rey doing the lightsaber training in the trailer, obviously you're from very far away and it just looks really cool and the music's swelling. This photo right here, beyond the side, like just the look of focus in her face, but just seeing her like do something with the lightsaber just looks absolutely awesome to me. Like, I'm so excited to see Daisy like rock the blue lightsaber and go head to head with, you know, Kylo Ren again and just dismantle some of the stormtrooper. Like, I'm just so excited for this. What do you guys think of these photos?
I love them. I love the whole photo shoot. The entire thing is incredible. I want copies of them, and I want to wallpaper my room. Like, they are that good. I love them.
Yeah, it also makes the background, like the islands and the water and everything around the island, just looks absolutely phenomenal. And then it also goes into one more photo of Rey in the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon. next to Chewie, which I will say he's looking very happy in there. But it looks like almost the Falcon's been updated in this. I don't know if it's been digital adjustments or, you know, what's going on, but I don't think I've ever seen a photo of the Falcon that looked this bright.
Well, if there's one thing that Rey's gotten really good at over the course of her life, it's cleaning things. She had to clean every scrap of metal that she took out of the desert, so she probably went over every inch of the Falcon and got rid of all the crap that Han left sitting around.
Except, is the back of her chair ripped? Like, it looks like the chair itself is ripped.
Well, she didn't learn how to sew. Just scrub. Okay. That's it.
Just scrub yes. All the stuff. Yeah, but I will say, it's interesting to see these photos because you see a couple different things in them. Again, we talked about Luke, but I would say almost Rey is more interesting in these photos because obviously she's in all three of them. But is it just me or does she look like she's got a blaster in the third photo? Like just holstered to her hip also? Is that like a Luke Skywalker Cloud City style blaster and lightsaber?
Is that the pistol that Han gave her?
It looks like the same pistol Han gave her.
Which makes me happy that she kept it.
Well, you brought this point up earlier, Diane, that it takes place right after the events of Force Awakens. So, you know, I would be surprised if she got rid of it. I wonder if Luke will do the lightsaber as a weapon that's not as clumsy, as a blaster. Anyway, moving on from that, we get some additional stuff about Poe and a new character named Paige, who he's coaching. To be a gunner, which is absolutely awesome. And we also learned that Paige, who is played by Vietnamese actress Veronica, I can't say the last name. Go. That's what I was thinking. I don't know. I might
no,
say
it's no. So it's no. Really hard oh, really? To say because it's got a very, very. It's not no. I'm so bad at Vietnamese. Like, so bad.
I know.
Of all of, like, Asian languages, the one I'm the worst at.
So, played by an actress named Veronica. I'll do that. We'll just do that. It's spelled NGO, so if someone can say it. If you guys want to leave a voicemail, you know, you can let us know. But she's a gunner being coached by Poe, which is awesome because we also find out that Paige is the sister of Rose, who's our mechanic that goes on a crazy adventure with Finn. Which I thought this was cool to find out that we have another character that we're going to get spotlighted in this film. And I'm not worried, but I'm excited and a little like nervous to see how this all is going to play out because I feel like there's a lot of new characters and a lot of new places. And I want them to give enough time to all of them. But, you know, who knows?
I'm sure that they will because they're all happening in like groups. It's not that you're focusing on just one character. You know, you're focusing on multiple characters in one location. So, you know, I would imagine that until Rose and Finn go off on their adventure, we're going to see Rose, Finn, Poe, Paige, and Leia together, because they're all very likely going to be on the Resistance base. So chances are we're going to see all of them together. Very likely, Laura Dern's character, who is also part of the Resistance, will very likely also be there at some point as well. So, you know, it's not going to be that we have to spend, like, significant time with each one of these characters individually. They will probably appear in several scenes together in groups. So I'm not that concerned about it, honestly.
And that's not too different than how every other saga film has been.
Yeah,
but I think the key to pulling that off is just good editing, which Episode 2 did not have, and that's why that one feels like a chopped salad that doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah,
true. maybe that's what it is. I just rewatched Attack of the Clones, and that might be why, you know, we did our episode on Django, but I feel like I'm a little worried, and I'll be honest, the reason why I say I feel like there might be too much going on, maybe I'm completely wrong. I'll be wait to see. I'm excited for it all, but maybe they'll fix it by doing like what I love is they'll release novels and comics and all these other things. So that way, when you get a character like Nine Nub, who, you know, was introduced, but is such a small role in, you know, Return of the Jedi, you find out that he's now part of, you know, Poe's squadron, and he, you know, what he did in between, you know, so it's, you know, so he makes a character come out and you're happy with him. He gets his own playable character in the video game. Anyway.
With the awesome laugh emote.
Yeah. Exactly. Again, looking at the photo there, again, it's, you know, you got General Leia, Poe, Finn, and Rose all hanging out there with BB-8. And we know that Rose and Finn are moving on another amazing adventure, going to an awesome glittery casino city. So not a cloud city, but a casino city called Canto Bight. B-I-G-H-T.
I love the idea of this city. Like, just the... They've got a load of pictures of what it's mm-hmm. going to be like in the article. And can I just say that this is so exciting. Like, it's so over-the-top opulent. The one thing that we haven't really seen from Star Wars is, like... We've seen significantly, and most obviously, other than the little bit of royalty on Naboo, for the most part, we haven't really seen how upper class live and what they do and how they behave. And it's very likely that they are around in the universe, and how are they affected by the power balances and imbalances in, like, the First Order vying for power versus the public versus, you know, the resistance. Where do they fall on all of that? And for me, this is, like, something that is significantly interesting, because I know that what Mike's going to say is that, well, Cloud City was supposed to be like this sort of luxury place, exclusive place, but it's nothing like this. This is very...
I know.
This is very over-the-top opulent excess and, like, significant money. Cloud City, to a certain extent, still had, like, this grounded family feel that Lando was going to do anything to protect the people under his charge. Like, he would do anything, and it still felt very sort of, I guess, almost, like, upper middle class rather than, like, upper class. So, there is a distinct different feeling of how this looks. And
so,
it
you're
is,
saying, like, Cloud City was, like, a concert at, you know, a sports arena, whereas this is, like, an opera type, you know?
I mean, I would say this is more like avant-garde fashion show.
Although I will say, this reminds me a little bit of, and I'm glad Evan's on because he'll be able to relate to this. Kind of reminds me of, like, the casino in Star Wars The Old Republic, where you can go and you can literally gamble and do stuff. And, like, I feel like it's going to have that feel. And I'm also excited to see what type of music it's going to have here.
I know, yeah, you're talking about, like, I was thinking the same
music,
thing.
But it's not going to be like cantina style music, but I feel like it's going to be it's not going to be like, you know, the Plagueis the Wise, you know opera music that you have in the background of, you know, Revenge of the Sith. I feel like it's going to be something that it's going to be catchy, but, you know, very highbrow, if you will. Like, I'm excited to see this, though, because I want to see how it all mingles together.
I think it's going to have much more of a vibe of, like, a Casino Royale than even, like, the seedy, like, bright neon, you know, holographic dancing girl
this
casinos.
This is more Monte Carlo than Las Vegas, so.
Very Monte Carlo versus Las Vegas on it, so I'm happy with it. I do want to go back, because you mentioned somebody earlier. You mentioned Vice Admiral Haldo, which was played by Laura Dern. So we got a couple photos of her, which I think is just absolutely amazing and stunning. Like, the purple hair, the drapery, you know, outfit and everything. It reminds me almost of, like, a Mon Mothma-style character. What do you guys think about Laura Dern's character, this Vice Admiral?
I love that she has dyed her hair. Like, I don't know why, there's something about it that I just absolutely love, that her hair is purple.
How do you know she dyed her hair? Maybe her hair is naturally purple.
I mean, they have confirmed that she is a fully human character, so unless humans at some point in the Star Wars universe have genetically been able to have purple hair.
Well, but see, you're humans you from never millions know. Of different planets, you just never know.
I guess. I mean,
I don't know, maybe it's like a makeup thing. Like, you know, you could put like makeup, you know, purple makeup on and her hair matches the same color. Who knows? We'll see.
But, maybe she grew up idolizing Sabine, and she's just like, you know what, different hair color every day.
Every episode. Exactly. So this also brings up another character who we were introduced to, who they call DJ, and we'll find out why they call him DJ, played by none other than Mr. Del Toro, who is this shady character, kind of a unknown, where his allegiance lies. I kind of feel like this is a Lando Calrissian-style character, if that makes sense, where you're kind of like, is he? No, kind of like we think about when we first introduced Lando, like Han comes up to, he's like, you got a lot of nerve coming here. Like, and then he instantly flips it around, but then he turns them into Vader. Like, you're kind of all over the place with Lando when you first meet him. And I feel the same thing here. He looks kind of like just a scoundrel outlaw. Not as flashy as Lando, I would say, but definitely, a mix between like Han Solo meets some type of other smuggler or outlaw, if you will. Like, I like the trench coat with him. What do you guys think of Benicio Del Toro as DJ, the shifty character?
Very interesting. I will say for anyone listening, DJ is not actually his name. It's just what the filmmakers call him for the express purpose of having something to call him. But he is going unnamed in the film, apparently. So, yeah. It's just in the interest of having something to call him, other than, I guess, that guy.
So I wonder if they're going to name him before the toys come out, and you'll get a Benicio Del Toro toy, and you'll have the name. It's kind of like,
that's a good question.
Did they ever name Lobot in the movie? Like, I don't think they said his name, but you know who it is. Because of the toy and everything.
Well, they never said Wicked either, and we all know who that is.
No, it's Wicked. Exactly. So I feel like that's might be where we get like the actual name, or some type of... think of the other books that came out for Force Awakens, like the one-off like short stories about the smuggler and like the people that were in the cantina. Like the Crimson... what's the name of it? But you know which one.
Crimson Corsair, right? Sidonie Thano.
Yeah, like all those characters, like we didn't really learn about them in the
film, I guess even like characters from like Poe's squadron, like Jessica Pava and all of those, they weren't named in the film either. But I think the significant difference in this case is that he's being pushed or like suggested that he's going to have a larger part. So that's unusual.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, if he's
I would say Wicket was never named, and he had a very large part in the film, like as a catalyst. Like without Wicket, they would have never found the Ewoks, which means, you know, the Emperor's two best battalions down on Endor would have stopped the Rebel Alliance from ever destroying the shield generator.
I mean, do we know that
it wasn't
Wicket
for those
never
furry
said,
teddy bears?
I was going to say, do we know that Wicket never said his name ever? Or no one else said his name ever? Maybe we just didn't understand.
There you go. Exactly.
There you go. You're right. I don't know.
But with Benicio, they can't just come out and say, it's Ezra Bridger, 40 years later.
But they should. Anyway, moving on. Let's go to the next part here, because we're gonna spend all time talking about the new this vanity.
I know. I'm like really looking at the time going on, going, oh my god.
Just make it its own episode.
It's not too late for me, but Danya, I know it's like midnight for you. I do want to talk about this really piece, really nice part here between Poe Dameron and Princess Leia. Oscar Isaacs was talking about him and Carrie because they have the amazing, again, if you haven't had a chance, take a look at Vanity Fair, read it. It's not super spoilery, but they do talk about some things that we didn't know before. But he talks about this scene he had with Carrie and how they had to do the scene 27 times where Carrie is slapping Poe. And they did it 27 times, and he's like, Carrie leaned into it every single time. That makes me smile, like, I don't know how much, because I can just imagine her going, look how hard, like, I can see her slap him, and she just starts laughing, and, like, you see how hard I hit him. Like, I know Star Wars is not a big outtakes, like, funny outtakes type movie, but I would love for some of these to surface at some point in time, because I could feel like it would have just, like, the essence of Carrie Fisher in it, just like laughing in her smile and everything with it. Like, what do you guys think about this when
I feel
when you said that?
I mean, I feel like they will probably do something whenever it's released on Blu-ray or DVD. I feel like they will probably do a lot of behind the scenes stuff focused on Carrie, if only as like a tribute. Like a Carrie Fisher tribute will probably make it on the DVD or Blu-ray. If it does not, I will eat my goddamn head, because it's just, considering how much Rian Johnson has been like an advocate for filming behind the scenes stuff and taking loads of photographs, like it would be incredibly unusual that they do not have like a significant amount of extra content in order to do something like that. And considering how deeply they all felt about Carrie and how they know fans feel, I would be shocked if we did get something like that. But also, kind of like, this is going to reveal way too much about me. I'm kind of into the idea of Poe getting slapped. I don't know why.
Like, is this a fetish you have?
I don't know. Apparently, we'll this is a very, like, very specifically, I'm like, yeah, sure. Slap Poe. That is apparently something I'm into. It's like that hurt your favorites thing. I don't know, like, if anyone listens to this and reads, like, fan fiction or anything like that, it's always that idea of, like, or even if you write fan fiction, it's that idea of, like, putting characters through the absolute worst so you can give them comfort later thing. Like, I don't know, it's just kind of one of those things where I'm like, yeah, sure, okay, let's hurt Poe and then give him cuddles later, that's fine.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Right, BB-8 will be there.
Yeah, sure. Aww. BB-8 will be there.
Anyway, let's move on. Recording to everything. Let's move on. Let's move on to our spotlight topic now. Just because I, you know,
good idea.
We went to this interesting thought of Poe being slapped. So, geez, Danya. Anyway, so spotlight topic is first in a series of our crew of the Ghost. We have Spectre One, Mr. Kanan Jarrus, who was not born with the name Kanan, but was born as Caleb Doom. Which, if you've read the Kanan comics, you'll actually see this, where he was Caleb Doom, and he was a Jedi Knight or Jedi Apprentice at the time of Order 66, where he had to make his escape. But first of all, what do you guys think of just, you know, we know him as this character, and even though he has a different name, he never refers back to it or anything, and I get it, but once he's already joined the Rebel Alliance, do you think it's weird that he just never goes back to his original name?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I mean, come on, if you think, I mean, think about it logically. Order 66 is still active, so any Jedi that they come across, you know, they have to eliminate. You would imagine that there is a database somewhere.
But they know who Kanan Jarrus is. They know he's the Jedi Knight Kanan Jarrus. Like, they know that. Like, he smacks the Rebel, you know, in Rebels. He is a thorn in the side of the Empire. Yes. They send the Inquisitors after him. They send Vader after him.
Yeah,
they
that's much later. That's after Ezra. Like, that's a significant amount. Like, you spend the first little bit of Season 1 where there's something not quite right, and you can't quite put your finger on it with Kanan. Like, I think it's like the first episode or so, and they can't quite, you can't quite figure it out until it's revealed that he's actually a Jedi, because he recognizes, like, how strong with the Force that Ezra is, but you would imagine that up until that point, to a certain extent, he's keeping under the radar. So, you know, I would say that if he was going around being known as Caleb Doom, like, if there was a database of Jedi, which I would be surprised if there wasn't, if he goes around using that identity, it's going to raise a red flag immediately. Like, it makes it makes significantly more sense until he is at a point where he is safe, secure, and able to use and be, well, not even use his real name, but like he's adopted and assumed the identity of Kanan Jarrus at that point, decided that is the just life he's going to live. Then it's almost like a rebirth for him, I would say.
Yeah, and you know, he kind of re-embraces his Jedi powers and everything as Kanan Jarrus. So let's talk about real quick the content where we get this. So Kanan, if you want to know more about Kanan, we have three bits of material I guess we can look at as canon for him. We have the Kanan comics, volume 1 and 2, which I think there's, what, 12 comics in the series?
Yes, okay. That's correct.
And then there's the novel, which is, again, canon. It's called A New Dawn. And it's actually, that novel involves him meeting Hera and joining the Ghost. And then you get, obviously, Rebels season 1 through 4, which 4 is not out yet, so season 1 through 3 is where we're at now. And you know, I'll be honest, I actually have not finished all the Kanan comics myself. I just started volume 2. I bought the, I guess you, what did you call them last week, Danya? The full, all the books, the series together? I don't know.
Trade paperback?
Yeah.
The trade, yeah, well, I bought it, the trade, through the app on my iPad. So I just like tap and it moves me to the next panel, which is really cool.
I do love that.
It is pretty cool. So I haven't finished it just because, you know, life and work and everything else. But I will say they're very well done. And I like how we introduce more to kind of a flashback style in Kanan, learning about his Jedi Master and where he was at. Do you guys want to talk anything about specifically his meeting of Obi-Wan, foreshadowing the signal to stay away? That specific meeting on the Jedi Temple when he was a very inquisitive Padawan. When they talked about there is a signal that will recall all the Jedi Knights to back to the temple. And then he even asked, is there a way to tell people not to come back? And it's Kanan who, you know, directly impacts what happens in Revenge of the Sith.
My big takeaway from that scene, aside from the foreshadowing, is his inquisitive nature. So we already get the idea that he's, however he turns out, he's not going to be like your typical Jedi. He's not going to necessarily be a by-the-book kind of guy, because he wants to know the why behind things. And with that Jedi Order right before Order 66, you know, any why questions probably would have just been, because that's the way it is.
Yeah, well, and he actually even mentions that he's very, so I think in the volume 1, we get introduced to him and his Jedi Master, was a Depa Bilaba?
Yep, Depa Bilaba.
Depa Bilaba. You know, he's introduced as as the Padawan of her, and he even is like, you know, inner monologuing, saying about, like, of all the Padawans, you know, she chose me, and she reveals to him it's because of his inquisitive nature, him being kind of a troublemaker at, you know, the Jedi Temple, because he's constantly questioning. And she talks about not necessarily questioning the Jedi Council, or that he doesn't necessarily question, you know, the reasons behind it, but he wanted to know the reason why behind it. So his questions were never to question the actual decision, but to understand the reason why behind it. Whereas she chose him because she thought he might have questioned some of the actual choices that were made, some of the decisions. Because her specifically was questioning the decision of the Jedi taking on titles like General in the war versus keeping their traditional titles of Jedi Master and Jedi Knight. But that leads us right into Order 66, which we know from seeing Revenge of the Sith, Order 66 was to just, you know, have the clones turn onto their Jedi leaders. And Kanan at that time goes on the run. And this is where he partners with a kind of a scoundrel smuggler person named Janus Kazmir.
Yep.
Anyone know how to say that? See, my problem with some
of
these
things ever been,
I don't know how you actually say them.
Yeah, I think you don't hear Janus Kazmir is as good a guess as any.
Janus Kazmir, that's what I would say. And Janus shows up also in the New Dawn book, where, you know, at this point, you know, it kind of leads him how to survive on his own. At this point, he kind of hides off. You know, he doesn't use his lightsaber. He's actually hidden it. He's not even keeping it on himself like he does when we see him in season one of Rebels, where he puts it together. What do you guys think about, you know, Kanan kind of trying to suppress his abilities as a Jedi? You know, his connection to the Force. You know, he's working in a mine, like he's doing manual labor, and he's just trying to hide from the Empire.
I mean, again, Order 66 is still in effect until they have confirmation that all of the Jedi have been eliminated. And I would assume that the best thing for him to do in order not to raise an alarm of the fact that, oh, hey, there is a Jedi still alive and here and active, like, is to lie low. I mean, it's all about, at this point, survival. He's isolated. He's alone. Doesn't know any other Jedi, really, at that point. It's just him. And so there's no safety in numbers for him. In fact, the safety in numbers just didn't even work out anyway. So it makes a significant amount of sense that would be trying to integrate into a civilian life in order to, I guess, keep his head down and, I don't know, still live. Like, it makes a lot of sense. You do what you have to survive. You lie low until the opportunity presents itself to be able to fight back again from a position where you are in a place where you can make more of an impact. At that particular point, Kanan, as he is never going to be able to fight them all off. In fact, even like small rebellious things is only ever going to bring down the full force of the Empire on him. Which is why it's so beautiful to see the progression of him through Rebels and how he starts fighting back in small ways till it kind of snowballs all the way up to the Rebel Alliance. Like, it's such an incredible journey from that point on.
Yeah, it really is. Like, going through the life of Kanan Jarrus, if you will, he is on this planet Gorse and just kind of lying low, doing manual labor, and then he meets Hera Syndulla, which puts a lot of things in effect. Like, a lot of things start happening as soon as he meets Hera, and including even facing off against, you know, coming face to face with Rae Sloane and Count Vidian, who's kind of like the main villain of the A New Dawn novel, if you will. But Rae Sloane, who we know is also in the Aftermath series, as the main protagonist. So it's one of those things where it all kind of ties together, and it ties Rebels to the larger Star Wars universe also. So I was a fan of how all that worked. Evan, I know you've read all the content. What do you think about Kanan kind of meeting Hera and moving on as part of him before he becomes Spectre One and a leader of the Ghost Crew?
I love his appearance in New Dawn, primarily because he's such a slime ball, at least to me it seemed that way.
He is!
He was just, like, drinking all the time, and he meets Hera and just, like, chases after her. He just wants... He just wants to get in her pants. That's all he's trying to do at that point.
He's like, who's that cute Twi'lek, you know? It was, yeah.
I mean, from another perspective, thinking about it from how Kanan must have been feeling and why he's potentially turn to that kind of life specifically, we've got to remember that any kind of significant attachment or family or anything that he's ever known, even though they don't encourage attachment or love as part of the Jedi Order, he lost it all, everything. So he's got no meaningful connection with anyone at all, and sometimes the way that you try and deal with that is by continuing to not have meaningful connections with people. You tend to, I guess, move in a self-destructive kind of circle of trying to make some kind of physical connection with someone in order to mask the fact that you are desperately alone. So I guess it doesn't necessarily make me feel as though it's unusual for Kanan to have gone in that direction. Yes, he comes across a little bit sleazy, but considering the trauma that he's gone through up until that point, it makes a lot of sense that what he's searching for is almost a meaningless physical connection with someone.
And considering he spent the last 10-plus years as a smuggler and living the smuggler lifestyle.
Yeah.
Or you can take a more Jedi approach and say it was the will of the Force for him to go down this path and have him meet up with Hera and find her attractive and chase after her to lead him into his greater destiny to help free Lothal.
And there
See,
is Mikey.
The Force
the
encourages
romantic.
Love, not the Jedi.
Yeah.
The Force moves in mysterious ways. I'm just saying, you know, if finding Anakin was the will of the Force, maybe finding Hera was the will of the Force, too.
I mean, I believe that. Just finding Hera would
there
be the
go.
Will of my Force, so, you know.
She's a Force in herself. She's a Force herself, which we'll definitely have to talk about her soon. So this leads us, okay, so obviously they meet up, they do, you know, I'm not going to recap A New Dawn. You can read that yourself. It's a great book, and if you don't have it, it's a phenomenal audiobook, too. I have it on audiobook. This leads us to Rebels Season 1. Season 2 and Season 3, specifically when we meet Kanan as leader of the Ghost Crew, you know, Spectre 1, obviously has a partnership with Hera, but he is the leader. You know, Hera's the captain of the Ghost, but as Kanan has this background with military and wanting to do the right thing, and so he's definitely the leader of the Ghost Crew, and he meets this unique kid in Episode 1 of Rebels, this young kid named Ezra Bridger. And Ezra himself, you know, without spending a bunch of time talking about Ezra on this episode, he pushes Kanan's buttons. Like, Kanan has to grow up a little bit and evolve as a leader because of Ezra. And he says something really, really interesting is when we talk, and I mentioned, like, could it be the will of the Force that Kanan found Hera? I personally feel like it was, you know, it was destined for Kanan to find Ezra, because he says one line to Ezra in the first episode of the first episode arc. It says, "You can keep the lightsaber you stole, let it become just another dusty souvenir, or you can give it back and come with us. Come with me and be trained in the ways of the Force. You can learn what it truly means to be a Jedi." At this point, early on, Episode 1 of Rebels, you see Kanan stepping into his role as a leader and as a Jedi, obviously in hiding. What do you guys think about Kanan and meeting Ezra, and just kind of taking on this mentor role?
I think the whole evolution of Kanan through each of the seasons is it all comes down to Ezra, you know, pushing him to be better, because he freely admits that, you know, he was not fully trained. He didn't know the right way, in air quotes, to be someone's master.
Yeah.
And, you know, he has to kind of figure it out.
Mm-hmm. He even goes so far as, like, when they get tricked into trying to find Jedi Master Luminara, who has been dead, but by using her bones, you know, Kanan is so quick to jump at it and tell Ezra that it's not that he wants to give him up, that he's no hope, it's just that he doesn't think he's ready to become, you know, this Jedi Master, you know, be his master. He doesn't think he's good enough. Whereas I think Ezra says it best, is like, hey, you know what? I think you're good enough. You know, you're perfect for me. And I think that works. I think it works for the two of them. Because, you know, they have the, they have this relationship that reminds me of Obi-Wan and Anakin. Especially not only that we saw in the movies, but also that we saw in the Clone Wars series. So it's that same familiarity as they obviously grow and make each other and push each other and make each other better. But in this time, they also are introduced to a character named the Grand Inquisitor and other Inquisitors, you know, Seventh Sister and Eighth Brother. But they're introduced against these Inquisitors, and it brings out a whole other side to Kanan, especially at the end of season one. If you remember that far back, against the Grand Inquisitor, where Kanan feels that he has lost Ezra. He feels that the Inquisitor has killed Ezra, and Kanan has nothing left to fear. You know, during the entire first season, you know, he's constantly self-doubt about himself and about training Ezra and being an effective leader to not only the crew of the Ghost, but also to Ezra himself as, you know, a Jedi Master. And once he feels that, you know, Ezra is gone, he has no more fear, and he's able to easily, I would say, overpower the Inquisitor. What do you guys think about that change in Kanan when he is able to overcome his fear? Because the worst thing that he could imagine has happened already. Danya?
Uh-oh, Danya fell asleep.
No, I'm still here. For some reason, it just wasn't doing anything when I was speaking.
Oh, okay.
Did you talk into the microphone? Anyway, let's move on, Danya. I'm asking the simple questions. It could be simple. So, Evan or Danya, or both of you, what do you think about this change in Kanan when he was able to finally let go of his fear and really evolve as a character at the end of season one?
I mean, I really, really love how Kanan kind of evolved, and especially like towards the end of season one. I think it's so interesting because even just over the course of the season, you see such huge leaps in his character since meeting Ezra and taking Ezra on. So for me, it's just like, it's a natural progression, but it's just so interesting to me, like how, I guess to a certain extent, though he's not or doesn't or never felt like he was ready to be a master, everything that happened in season one was all about him learning to be the best Jedi that he could be. And that was without like the Jedi Order kind of dictating what that meant. Like, it's the right kind of Jedi for the right kind of time, and he evolves, progresses in his own way. And I just think, yeah, I love it so much. Just this whole progression of.
Evan, any thoughts on this change in Kanan at the end of season one?
Well, I really do enjoy the fact that he's not trying to just teach Ezra or treat other people the way that he thinks the Jedi Order would have wanted him to do it. Because I have so many problems with the Jedi philosophical system of that era. And I think, you know, whether he realizes it or not, that there were issues, like Danya said, he's doing what needs to be done, and you know, that can be taken the wrong way sometimes, but he understands the value of keeping people close to you. You know, they keep you grounded. He keeps Ezra grounded, and Ezra keeps him grounded. So the quote-unquote bad attachments, you know, are something that he is probably not thinking about, but he is definitely embracing them. And, you know, it's not really the attachments themselves that cause issues. It's what you do when those attachments are threatened. And so far, he has not made those bad decisions that we typically think of when, you know, we see someone with, ooh, attachments, or ooh, they're afraid.
Yeah, well, I also think it's one of those things where, unlike Anakin Skywalker, you know, and I guess you can tie a parallel between Anakin Skywalker and Kanan, especially with their Padawan versus Anakin's love for Padme. You know, Anakin had a fear of losing Padme, preventing her death, which led him down, obviously. You know, Yoda saying, fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, hate leads to suffering. You know, that's exactly where he went. He was feared. Kanan had the same thing. He had fear for his Padawan, feared he was going to fail, you know, all those things. And when he thought he lost his Padawan, he thought he lost Ezra, that fear that he had was no longer there, and he was able to overcome it. And luckily, unlike, you know, Anakin, who just went spiraled so far down, you know, down the dark side, you know, Kanan was able to not only defeat the Inquisitor, but see that Ezra was still alive and kind of recover from that. But that leads into kind of season two, and I would almost say jumping almost to the finale of season two, where, you know, Kanan and the rest of the Gross have befriended Fulcrum, and they meet up with Rex, who again from Rebels or from Clone Wars, and Ahsoka and Ezra go to, as it was Malachor, which is a Sith world, that they find not only more Inquisitors, but they encounter Darth Maul, more Inquisitors, and Vader. And it's during this time that, you know, Kanan still has a little fear, but his fear is not for himself, but for Ezra. Is he leading Ezra astray? Is Ezra understanding the temptation of the dark side? You know, Luke said it best in a new, you know, asking Yoda, is the Empire, is the dark side stronger? No, and it's just easier. Or maybe it was Obi-Wan. Who did Luke ask it to? I have to think back to the scene.
Yoda.
It was Yoda. No, and it says not stronger. It's just, you know, easier.
Quicker, more seductive.
Thank you. So it's one of those things where he's worried about Ezra falling down that path because it is going to be quicker. It's easier. And we see at the beginning of season three that Ezra is kind of falling down that. But I think by the end of season three, we can all say that Ezra has given that up. But in this fate, you know, in the end of season two, you know, Kanan gets confronted with Darth Maul. I think it's the big takeaway for him. Obviously, the Inquisitors are an obstacle to get over, but they've just been kind of almost a nuisance to them as Jedi and to freedom fighters throughout the galaxy. But he faces Darth Maul, and Darth Maul doesn't necessarily get the best of him, but does injure him to a point where I think it hurts him more that he is planning to take Ezra as his apprentice, his Sith apprentice, than just the damaging of Kanan's eyesight. What do you guys think about Maul and Kanan's kind of confrontation between the two?
Yeah, I think when we see him at the beginning of season three and he's in that depressed state and doesn't really know what to do with himself, I think it does have less to do with the loss of his vision and more with the fact that he feels like he wasn't able to be what Ezra needed to keep him from, you know, being taken in by the dark side. So, yeah, in fact, the blindness that occurs from the injury sustained by Maul is, to him, I'm sure it's all wrapped up in you know, one package, but it's almost minor. At later on, it becomes seemingly a minor inconvenience compared to the possibility of having Ezra go to the dark side.
I'll agree with you that it's definitely the loss of his eyesight affected a couple things specifically in that final encounter. Is obviously it forced Ezra to help him out. They left Ahsoka to face Vader alone, who, you know, hopefully we find out what Ahsoka's, you know, fate is come next season. So, you know, so he has a lot of, you know, you're right. You know, he goes into this depression funk, not the binge drinking that he was in for the 10 years before he met Hera, but kind of this depression of, you know, what is he going to do? You know, he doesn't have his eyesight. He lost, you know, Ahsoka, who he saw as almost a mentor instantly. And then, you know, now Ezra is leading his own because Kanan is just not ready to get back out there. But he is introduced to a character called the Bendu, who kind of puts certain things in perspective for Kanan. You know, that even though, and I think the Bendu is kind of puts a lot of perspective, even in not just for Kanan, but for like the Last Jedi that we'll see with Luke, is that it's not one or the other. That's not balance. You know, he's somewhere in the middle. And I think Kanan is kind of stepping towards that way when he's able to reconnect with Ezra. And even the starting of Sabine's training, where Hera tells him Sabine is not Ezra, they're different. And so they kind of go, you know, it's cool to see Kanan, even being blind, go head to head with Sabine at full on, like, to train her in the use of the Darksaber. What do you guys think about him overcoming that blindness, meeting the Bendu, and reconnecting with Ezra and training Sabine?
I don't know that there was ever any real question that he was going to overcome the handicap of, you know, losing his eyes. And we've seen plenty of blind Jedi and blind samurai throughout, you know, so many stories. But yeah, even that training, the training scene with Sabine was a really cool scene to see. And, you know, I immediately tweeted out that he had become Daredevil, the man without fear, because that's exactly what he was at that point.
Yeah, he kind of just became that person. You know, he just kind of took it all in. You know, at the end, you know, I'm excited to see what happens with Kanan going forward. You know, he had this showdown with Thrawn where it wasn't so much him, but more him getting the Bendu to help out, which the Bendu just was, like, angry with both Kanan, the Rebels, and Thrawn's horses, but kind of let the Rebels
and
get
and
away.
No, we're not going to have Tom Baker next season. That makes me sad.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth Doctor is not going to be in it.
Well, we'll see what happens at the end of this next season, because there's a lot of
you're
cool
right.
stuff
we,
coming.
You're right. We you don't know.
We don't know yet. We don't know. But overall, you know, Kanan is an interesting character. He has had a very interesting past, obviously. Having survived through the Clone Wars, actually being part of the Clone Wars, going into hiding, coming out to find a new kind of role as himself, as a freedom fighter, joining the crew of the Ghosts, joining the Rebellion as a whole at larger, because we've, you know, he's met people like Princess Leia, Lando Calrissian. I would love for him to meet a Han Solo at some point in time in his travels. But, you know, he's met the, you know, a bunch of the big people already. Anything else about Kanan Jarrus?
Not for me. I think we covered his whole life.
Yeah, I'm just really looking forward to him and Hera next season. I just, everything about them I love. So, more of content.
I would love to see the end of season 4 be with the crew of the Ghosts going to the Battle of Scarif or something like that, and seeing what happens to them there. That would be fun. And I would love to see how Kanan kind of is involved in that, because he knows he's not going to be the one to bring down Vader. He knows that there's someone else once Ezra talks to Obi-Wan on Tatooine. So we'll see what happens with Kanan coming up in season 4 of Rebels. But as always, thank you all for listening to another episode of Resistance Radio. Feel free to reach out to us on Twitter at @rradiopodcast or on Facebook at facebook.com/resistanceradiopodcast. Remember to visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/resistanceradiopodcast. As always, I'm Mikey B.
I'm Danya.
I'm Evan.
And may the Force be with you.
And also with
you.